Why a flaming chalice? Why a flaming chalice? The question comes. It is the cup of life, we answer. A cup of blessings overflowing, a cup of water to quench our spirit's thirst, a cup of wine for celebrating and dedicating, the flame of truth, the fire of purification, of oil for anointing, for healing. Out of chaos, fear, and horror, thus was the first symbol of fire crafted a generation ago. So may it be for us in these days of uncertainty, sorrow, or rage. Let this be a light to warm our souls and guide us home. The words of Reverend Lisa Dodge. Now welcome you to a time for all eight.
Hello. I'm going to tell a story today, and one of the things about stories is they quite often tell you a lot about the people who told the story, the people who originated the story. In a sense, especially when we're talking about creation stories, which I'm about to tell you, a creation story that's told by the people of the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes, the Mohawk, the Seneca people, the Huron people. You have five or different language groups, not just maybe 25 different languages, but they all tell variations of this story. And what does the Great Lakes have in common? Water. Water. So the people of the Great Lakes were able to communicate with each other because they were able to canoe from one place to another along the Great Lakes, and share the stories, and pretty soon the stories would be enriched by each people's insights. Now the story I'm going to tell you is called The Woman Who Fell from the Sky. Because in the beginning, according to these people, everything was water. It was all water and sky. Water and sky. And there were the creatures who live in the air, birds, and there were the creatures who lived in the water, fishes and turtles and all of those kinds of creatures. They lived in the water. But there was no space for people who would like to live on the land, or animals who would like to live on the land. And up in the sky, the squirrels were getting a little crowded, running around on clouds and things like that. Deer, the bobcats. So it became a time when there was a kind of a cry, let us have land. Well, one day the birds were flying along the sky, and they were searching, looking around, because something was about to happen and they didn't quite know what it would be. And suddenly they see the sky, a big hole in the sky. And they see a woman falling out of that hole. A woman falling out of that hole. The birds calculate, did a little mathematics in their head, and they said at the rate she's falling, she's going to hit the sea at a very high rate of, and it's going to be a big splash and it's going to hurt her. So the birds said, this is not good. Women falling out of the sky. So they flew into formation and they flew under her, and they started flapping their wings under her, and the wind from the wings blew up into the, and slowed her down. The woman had been thoughtful enough to bring her prayer shawl with her. So it flowed in all kinds of directions as she moved across the sky. And she fell slowly, slowly. But the birds still were worried because what was she supposed to do when she got to the sea? Swim to the lake. Swim. That's a good question. Before there was land, was the water in seas or lakes? I've never thought of that before. Anyway, the water. So they started communicating with the creatures that lived in the sea. And after, as she started to move closer and closer, say, where the steeple of this church is, a turtle, a very large turtle, emerged in the water, and she landed on the turtle's back. And she immediately began to dance because she had brought her dancing prayer shawl, and it flowed out. And as she danced, land began to grow out from the turtle in all kinds of directions. And as she danced, she had also brought the seeds of life with her from the skies, from the heavens, from the world she lived in before, the seeds of life. And she scattered it out, 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 out along the way she danced. And she danced in all kinds of directions. And all kinds of plants started to grow. And the birds started catching squirrels coming out of the sky and chipmunks. And they all landed on the turtle. And there was the beginning of land. So in many peoples of the north, of North America, call this Turtle Island. And they wear turtles to show their respect for this planet, because this is North America. Oh, I was supposed to ask you. I gave you homework before, didn't I? What does the story tell you about the worldview of the people that created it? There are different, you've heard other creation stories. Winds blow over water and stuff like that. The Big Bang is that one. What is it?
It shows that the people had a strong connection to nature and animals.
And it showed that people and animals together created land, as opposed to, you know, like a Hebrew god creating the whole world. It's animals and people created land.
Other thoughts? Abby.
Real close. Yeah. And it showed that the life force for creation burst forth with joy, and all possibilities can happen.
It also showed the important role of a woman. The important role of a woman.
Well, there is no Adam in the story.
There is no Adam.
As we celebrate this weekend, we celebrate Martin Luther King. And Martin Luther King was always able to bring it right to us. He reflected, our nation was born in a genocide. It had embraced the doctrine that the original American, the Indian, was an inferior race, Even before there were large numbers of African Americans on our shores, the scar of racial hatred had already disfigured colonial society. From the 16th century forward, blood flowed in battles over racial supremacy. We are perhaps the only nation which tied as a matter of national policy to wipe out its original people. Moreover, we elevated that tragic experience into a noble crusade. Even today, we are not permitted ourselves to reflect or reject or have remorse for this shameful part of our history. Our literature, our films, our drama, our folklore all exalt in it. In the spirit of Martin Luther King, the prophet and the poet, let us join in a time of prayer and meditation. Source of all love that takes the side of justice, we are grateful to be together this morning. We gather especially to remember Dr. Martin Luther King and all who put their lives on the line so that we all may be free. May the work of Dr. King continue to eradicate the injustice wherever and whenever we encounter it. May we continue to speak out against injustice, speaking even if we are afraid. May the spirit of Dr. King continue to flow through our daily living. May we have the courage of Dr. King as we continue to stand up for justice, reconciliation, and truth, despite the challenge and controversy. Dr. King went to the mountaintop and he saw the promised land, a beloved community of mutuality, of peace built on justice, in a whole planet of peace, made strong by truth-telling and courageous reaching out. May it be so. May it come to pass.
Thank you. I have borrowed some words to introduce the collection this morning from the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, who is the current president of the Unitarian Universalist Association and has written on an integration of the old and the new in our thinking about Dr. King's legacy. She is deeply involved in the work of the Unitarian Universalist Black Lives Matter movement. And she shares this with us. Every day in our world, people are feeling vulnerable, frightened, and heartbroken. For those who are Black, Indigenous, or people of color, the effects of racism and oppression are everyday lived reality. These feelings are not new. For others, this present day can be a time of hard awakening to the realities that have existed for a long time. For all of us, the call of this moment is real. As Unitarian Universalists, we are invited and challenged every day to live more deeply into our faith. For us, that might mean accepting our invitation to build a new way, and we must do it together. We know that, as June Jordan said, we are the ones we've been waiting for. The power and the promise of this Unitarian Universalist faith is waking up to meet fear and hate with radical imagination, transformation, partnership, resilience, and joy. We make change possible through our commitment and our generosity. And it is in the spirit of Reverend Frederick Gray's words that we collect this morning's offering.
The responsive reading in our hymnal is number 614, and I'm going to work with that as I read. And it's interesting. You read the hymnal, and if you didn't, you look at, and it says that Black Elk wrote this responsive reading. Black Elk wrote the responsive reading. I've heard people say that. Black Elk wrote this, and Black Elk spoke only Lakota. Black Elk never knew how to write even in Lakota, so I guess he didn't write it. A missionary spent time with Black Elk, listened to Black Elk talking, and the missionary learned Lakota. And after a while, the missionary wrote a book called Black Elk Speaks. And Black Elk Speaks, and the responsive reading is taken from one of Black Elk's meditations recorded in Black Elk Speaks. So if you go on, you know, Jeopardy, and say, what did Black Elk write? You could say, he spoke in Lakota. Told story. So then I will read the Roman and you read the italics. Then I was standing on the highest mountain of them all. And while I stood there, I saw more than I can tell. For I was seeing in the sacred manner the shape of all things of the Spirit. And I saw the sacred hoop of my people was one of the many hoops that make one circle, wide as daylight and starlight. To shelter all the children of one mother, of one father. And you can assume that the missionary got some fancy words in there, too. I got to look at that.
Where are you? Took all the ordinances.
I took them all. I was very ungenerous. We have a brief interlude.
Okay.
Claudia? No? Ah, bell choir. Excuse me.
For the beginning of our offertory, we were introduced to the words of Susan Frederick Gray. And as you probably might have heard, some of you, many of you, your congregation is a member of the Unitarian Universalist Association, 1,000 congregations in the United States, and many relationships with many religious communities of Unitarians and Universalists in Europe and Australia and New Zealand, lots of places. So at the every year we meet, all the congregations meet, and this year it'll be very close to Framingham in Providence, Rhode Island. And your General Assembly Planning Committee, which is elected by the General Assembly, chose Providence, Rhode Island because it's close to Plymouth. And this is the 400th anniversary of the landing of the Mayflower, which I won't talk about the Mayflower today because you'll hear a lot about it later. It's also the 400th anniversary of the introduction of slavery into Jamestown. So you have the impact on the Wampanoag and Narragansett peoples and the impact on African American peoples. And we'll be talking about that in Providence. And so I've been asked to go around talking, reminding people about the doctrine of discovery. The doctrine of discovery. So once upon a time, in a land not very far from here, a sea captain sailing under the Spanish flag came ashore a little island that its inhabitants called Gunihani. The official Spanish narrative written by that sea captain reads, "Shortly after landing, many of the island's inhabitants assembled on the beach, and Columbus gave them gifts of red hats and beads. And the natives reciprocated with gifts of parrots and cotton and other goods." And then the sea captain, Columbus, writes, "They go as naked as when their mothers bore them, and so do the women, although I did not see more than one girl. They are very well made, with handsome bodies and very good countenances." Very good countenances. Sweet people. Then Columbus observed, "They will make great slaves." After taking gifts from the native Tiano, the Spanish performed a ceremony to take possession of the land for the king and queen of Spain, acting under the international laws of Western Christendom. Central to the ceremony was a reading in the Vulgate of Madrid, or which we now call Spanish, which the natives didn't understand. They hadn't gone to Spanish classes yet. Instructing the Tianos that they were subjects to Isabel and Ferdinand, and they were required to submit to her church. Resistance would mean rebellion. Rebellion would mean war. In a war, Spain would be required to subdue them, confiscate their property, and enslave them. That was all explained to them in Spanish. That was the law. Columbus proclaimed in Spanish to the Tiano-speaking islanders. Now, at that time, 1492, I think it was, right? There were 100 million people living in the Western Hemisphere, from Chile to Baffin Island and to Alaska. 100 million people. That's about what the same number as the people who lived in Europe at the time, from Istanbul to Dublin, to, Europe. 100 million people lived in the Western Hemisphere, had developed complex civilizations, advanced sciences, including horticulture. Much of the food we eat was cultivated in this hemisphere. before Columbus. Cultivate it. Don't grow wild potatoes, tomatoes, beans, squash, maize, corn. None of these things grew wild. They had to be cultivated over a year, thousands of years, from seeds to maize. Cultivated. And they understood the healing power of herbs and had insights into mathematics and astronomy that rivaled any people in the world at that time. In other words, the Western civilization, the Western hemisphere, rivaled Europe at that time. And if you think of people who, if it wasn't for the potato, Europe's population would never have grown, because the wheat was simply not sufficient. So based on that, many people ask, maybe you've asked yourself, how could America be discovered if people were already here? Not many people are aware that this act of discovery is based on a legal doctrine known as the doctrine of discovery. You ever talk to a lawyer about discovery?
No.
They find the evidence and they become possessing of the evidence, or the through asking people questions who already know the answer. So they discovered it, and it becomes discovery. So it's a process before a trial, or the discovery is that they know it and they claim it. So fewer people realize today that 5 centuries later, the laws of the United States regarding indigenous peoples are based on the doctrine of discovery. The legal doctrine of discovery. The doctrine of discovery is the basis of laws that deny the rights of indigenous peoples in all of the Americas, from the Arctic Circle to south of Chile, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands. All these people are claimed to be under the jurisdiction of the United States because of the doctrine of discovery. So in 2012, in preparation for the General Assembly, our partners among all the human rights organizations in Arizona, as well as the Native Americans in the United States, asked the Unitarian Universalists to examine this doctrine of discovery, this mysterious doctrine. They believed that through such an examination, the Unitarian Universalists would ever have a better understanding of how genocide and slavery was justified and still is justified, and how the justification gave rise to what we call racism. They hoped that this would help us as a faith community to have a deeper understanding of migration and border issues. You know, like the border didn't, we didn't cross the border crossed us. That, you've heard that? Impose a border on an area that's, the language of that the Aztecs spoke originated in Utah. So maybe there's a connection. So let us begin by examining the church's role, the papal document issued 40 years before Columbus's voyage. In 1452, Pope Nicholas V issued to King Alfonso V of Portugal the bull Romanus Pontifex, declaring war against all non-Christians throughout the world and instructing the conquest, colonization, and enslavement of non-Christian Africa. In 1453, Western Christianity had been launching crusades for 400 years at that point, crusades against Muslims, crusades against Jews, crusades against those who followed the indigenous religions of Europe, You may have heard of them. They're so-called pagans. And 1492 was a year where more witches were burnt in Europe than were burnt before in the 100 years earlier. It was just a peak year for witch burning. Based on these four centuries of war, non-Christians were considered enemies of the church and as such less than human. And according to the bull in 1452, Nicholas directed King Alfonso to capture, vanquish, and subdue the Saracens, pagans, and other enemies of Christ, and to put them into perpetual slavery, and to take possession of their property. And given this commission, Portugal began to capture African slaves by making discoveries along the coast of Africa, claiming those lands as Portuguese territory. So, fast forward. 1492. Columbus sailed west. He's authorized to take possession of any lands he discovered that were not under the domination of any Christian prince. Thus, following the established Christian discovery meant conquest, slavery, genocide followed. So yes, Columbus had a mandate. He had a commission. He was under orders. His commission did not read, "Find a shortcut to India." Didn't. It read, "Conquer somebody." For now, you're getting the plot of this story. Columbus returned to Europe. Pope Alexander VI, issues a papal document, Bull Intus Terra, May 3rd, 1493, granting to Spain, at the request of Ferdinand and Isabella, the right to conquer any lands that Columbus had already found, as well as any lands that Spain might discover in the future. By issuing Intus Terra document, Pope Alexander stated his desire that the discovered people be subjected and brought to the faith itself. By this means, the Christian empire would be propagated. And if you read Columbus's journal, this is kind of off the way. Columbus says, "Until such time as the whole world hears the gospel of Jesus Christ, the kingdom of God will never come." Okay, so you conquer them. From the point of view of the Europeans at the time, the law of nations asserted that Christian nations had a divine right based on the Bible to claim absolute title and ultimate authority to any newly discovered non-Christian inhabitants for their lands. And over this several centuries, was going on until about 1820 when Lewis and Clark was banging little nails into the trees as along the Missouri River and up into the Columbia River and claiming it. The picture of the little coin was Thomas Jefferson's. And he was claiming it for the United States under the doctrine of discovery. So it meant that Spain, Portugal, England, France, Holland, and by extension, Canada, the United States, Argentina, Chile, Brazil, the Republic of South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand all claim to be doctrine of discovery powers. Europe and its progeny claimed the world was there in the name of Christ. In 1823, the U.S. Supreme Court in Johnson versus McIntosh, Chief Justice John Marshall observed that the Christian nations had assumed ultimate dominion over the lands of America during the Age of Discovery, and upon discovery, he said, the Indians had lost any rights to the land and only retained the right of occupancy of their land. It had been taken because they were heathens, he said, pagans. In other words, the U.S. Supreme Court, Indian nations were subject to the ultimate authority of the first Christian nation to claim possession of their land, and that land was Great Britain, which according to Chief Justice Marshall, the United States, upon winning its independence in 1776, took Britain's right of claim. And became the discoverer and acquired the power of dominion from Great Britain. Supreme Court. Marshall specifically cited the English charter issued to the explorer John Cabot in order to document England's complete recognition of the doctrine of discovery. So now you know how you got to have this place. Then, paraphrasing the language of the charter, Marshall noted that Cabot had authorized to take possessions of the land irrespective or notwithstanding the occupancy of natives who were heathens. And at the same time admitting prior title of any Christian people who may have made a previous Christian discovery. So Spain had found Cape Cod first. They were to yield it. That's your Supreme Court. That's the law of the land, still being enforced. Indigenous people can't fish in this river without a permit from the government. Using this principle of discovery as its premise, the Supreme Court stated in 1831 that the Cherokee Nation, and by implication all indigenous nations, were not fully sovereign, but perhaps may be called domestic dependent nations. Wards of the state. Congress had taken this to mean that treaties made with Indian nations were subject at any moment to U.S. revision. Indian nations were considered legally like children, subject to congressional authority. Now, lawyers, scholars of the law, call that plenary power, the plenary power. The indigenous people of the Western Hemisphere call it colonialism, call it domination, and think it's racist nonsense. The ancient doctrine of Christian discovery and its subjugation of the heathen Indian is law of this land right now, today. This government of the people, by the people, for the people, is clearly a government of some people, by some people, for some people, and the right of the Corps of Engineers to dig a pipeline through a reservation in North Dakota is clearly going to be upheld by the courts. So let us look at some of the workings of this doctrine right here in New England. Massachusetts Bay Colony. The charter is issued by James under his authority because he claims land under James, King James, because he claims the land under this discovery by Cabot, who, by four sovereigns earlier, 120 years earlier. The Massachusetts Bay Colony picked fights with the Wampanoag, Massachusetts, and Pequot peoples so that they could be enslaved. And if you ask where did most of the indigenous people in Massachusetts and Rhode Island go, they went to the Sugar Islands as slaves. That's where they went. Because they would be rebels against Christian authority and shipped to the Bahamas in exchange for African slaves who were brought to New England to provide labor for the colonies. And those indigenous people who survived were those who converted to Christianity. And they were put in what's called praying towns. Natick was a praying town. There was other praying towns around here. The slaves were exchanged for African slaves who were brought here when you brought those indigenous people into the islands, they were exchanged for African slaves who were brought here to New England, provide labor for the colonies. Why? Well, we could dock a coffee hour. Well, but it's not a good idea, obviously, I guess, to you think about it, to keep indigenous people from Massachusetts in Massachusetts if they're going to be slaves. Because they, I mean, Christus Attucks. You've heard of Christus Attucks? Had a little snowball fight with the British troops. He was a runaway from the Natick, praying town of Natick. He was an indentured servant to a farmer in Framingham. And when he ran away from Framingham, this warrant was put out for him. His last name means running deer in Algonquin, Attucks. So we kind of think he, and where he came from. So that's what happened. They were put in praying towns and put out for indentured labor. These are not stories that are taught to you in public schools. And therefore, you kind of don't know the history of Massachusetts, of Oregon, or Missouri, or I mean, the indigenous nation who lived here was called the Massachusetts people. The names of half their place names are indigenous. But you don't, it's not part of the education system. The people who greeted Columbus on the beach knew that they belonged to the earth. They knew that anything they did to the earth, they did to themselves. Thus, they understood that they were relational beings. They were relational beings. Living in relationship to the earth and her creatures was life-giving and sustaining, and trying to own the earth, to control the earth, would lead to brokenness and ruin. So when we Unitarian Universalists repudiated the doctrine of discovery, when we said that we would fight against this doctrine of discovery and ally ourselves with indigenous peoples, with the African American people who have been victims of this doctrine of discovery, we promised we would tell the true story of this land. With all due respect, we would tell that story. And we would agree to overcome the legacy of conquest and domination. We say we live in a country where the church and state are separated. You heard that, right? And the laws are based on the principles of human rights and justice for all. We say that. And we say that every person has the freedom of religious expression and that no particular religion will be established and given privileged institutional status. I bet you've even said that yourself. Not only have you heard it, you've said it. But Unitarian Universalists have been learning in so many ways, that many laws in areas such as who can get married and who cannot, whether a woman can have reproductive choice, or what is taught in our schools about the origin of life, have been and continue to be subject to theological presumption, to the dictates of religious denominations. And so it is with the concept of discovery. The right of Christians to claim the world. The price of liberty is eternal vigilance, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religious expression. These are rights, but they're not given. They're expressions of the concept of what it is to be a human being, to be able to say and express your opinion and have your own understanding of the divine. It's a right in that sense, but it's not a given. We need to struggle We need to struggle for those freedoms. And yeah, Unitarian Universalism rose as a cry for freedom, freedom of mind and spirit, freedom to side with love. But the doctrine of discovery continues to be the law of this land, enforced by the courts, and enforced by the courts in Massachusetts no more than 5 years ago. It is the law that enables the government to disregard treaties and agreements with indigenous peoples. To side with love is to join in struggle and to overcome the legacy of conquest and violence, and to tell the story of this 12,000 years of history of this land. And while you're doing all that struggling and fighting and hoping and praying, you can sing. So let's sing number 212, We Are Dancing Sarah's Circle. Dancing Sarah's Circle, because we are part of a multi-generational humanity. We shall overcome when we truly extend our hands to one another in loving acceptance. We shall overcome a past that unexamined will haunt us. Living in peace and freedom, we shall overcome the wrongs that have happened and the debts left unpaid. So let us join together in that commitment. Yes, we shall overcome, and we shall go in peace, and we shall go in love. Go in peace.